Welcome to Inside the New York Times Book Review. I'm Sam Tannenhaus. This week, a conversation with Nathan Harden, who discusses his provocative new book, Sex and God at Yale.
At least for me, the extreme elements of some of the pornography that was screened in classrooms, some of the violence of it, that did create a lot of controversy among students.
Julie Bosman has notes from the field. Pamela Paul guides us through this week's special back to school issue.
You know, the academy is going on this, you know, terrible downward slope, and yet a lot remains the same.
And Parle Sagel has bestseller news. This week is our special back to school issue, and yet again, parents are wondering what goes on these crazy college campuses. There is a provocative new book with a provocative title called Sex and God at Yale, Porn, Political Correctness, and a Good Education Gone Bad. It's by Nathan Harden, and it's reviewed on our cover by Hannah Rosen, who says Harden brings impeccable credentials to this task and makes many telling points. I'm delighted that Nathan's here to talk about his book. Welcome.
Hey, thanks for having me, Sam.
All right, so let's get to your story. It's a really interesting story. You're from Tennessee, and
yes.
You were homeschooled, right?
I was, yes, but I did not grow up churning butter or making my own clothes out of burlap. I had a pretty normal childhood.
Well, in fact, as Hannah Rosen says, you kind of look like a rock star. So whatever preconceptions there are, we'll set
yes.
aside. But then you went off to Yale, and what year were you a freshman there?
I entered Yale as a transfer student. I had a very circuitous path in my education. So, you know, I got there first in 06 and graduated in 09.
That's right. You'd actually applied a couple of times and not been admitted. Hey, this is a very tough university.
That's right. You know, I think they just got fed up with turning me away and they finally relented and there I was.
There's a lot to get into here. So let's start with what your expectations were. Here you go to one of the greatest universities on the planet. What were you expecting when you walked onto the Yale campus first, and then what did you find?
For me, when you walk on campus as a freshman, or in my case as a transfer, when your first day there, you're immediately swept into a sense of, I'm a part of history.
Well, those giant Gothic
buildings. Towers, yeah. Yes. It's beautiful. I mean, it's not only one of the greatest universities in the world, it's also one of the most beautiful. I got there expecting this elite, fantastic education, and in many respects, Yale delivered. But in many other respects, it failed to deliver in quite extravagant fashion.
You write at some length, in some detail, about its topic some of our listeners will be aware of, but some won't. It's called Sex Week.
Tell us
about that.
Well, Sex Week is probably the most shocking material in the book. It's this festival that they've held every other year for the last decade or so. In every incarnation, it seemed to grow progressively more extreme. And it was populated primarily by corporate personalities from the sex industry. So you had porn stars of various kinds, porn production companies coming to market and distribute their films, sex toy companies giving sort of bawdy how-to sessions on all kinds of battery-powered contraptions.
Where was all this taking place? Not in the classroom.
Yeah. Yes, in the same hallowed halls where Dante and Shakespeare and Aristotle and Plato are supposed to be discussed. There we learned about many subjects of a quite different nature.
Now, who sponsors Sex Week? Because it's a complicated issue. Is it the university itself? The president of the university declares this is Sex Week and part of your education? Or is this something that goes on sort of in a different track with – you mentioned corporate sponsors. How does it all happen? How does it work?
Well, no, I don't think the president of Yale has ever come out and put his picture on any of the brochures for this. It's been primarily student organized, and for most of its history, it's been sponsored, paid for, in other words, by corporate sponsors. A lot of those have been in the form of donation, but there's been a lot of very hefty cash donations from sex toy companies and so forth that have helped it go on. My argument I make is that Yale's leaders are responsible for whatever happens in the classroom. While I think with a lot of the negative media coverage that Sex Week has generated in the last few years, their attitude has been kind of to wash their hands of it.
This is the administration.
Yeah, and I take a different view. I say, listen, you know, what students do on their own time, in the privacy of their dorms, that's one thing. But when you open up the doors of a Yale classroom, then you're putting a kind of de facto sponsorship or endorsement of whatever's going on there. And in that case, I think it needs to be serious intellectual inquiry. And it certainly shouldn't be co-opted by for-profit companies who are really there to market their tawdry products rather than to educate in any serious way.
Does it really last all week?
Oh, the week is actually very deceptive because these sex weeks lately have gone anywhere from 11 to 14 days. So it's closer to 2 weeks by the time you end up. Yeah.
And is it during the day? Would there normally be a humanities course? You're reading the Iliad and the Odyssey, but right. Instead this is going on? In other words, this is replacing academic work, or is it scheduled in such a way that the classroom is given over to that?
You know, at a place like Yale, there are extracurricular lectures and seminars being held all the time. Many of them are extraordinary. I mean, you have Nobel laureates coming in to read their poetry. You have Tony Blair coming to give some talk, and you have, as a Yale student, you spend most of your time trying to figure out what you can afford to miss out of all these great events. So Sex Week kind of falls into that bracket. It sort of runs in parallel to all the normal classwork, but it's going on throughout the day, throughout the night, you know, everything from masturbation how-tos, are we allowed to say that word in here, to oral sex seminars, again, sex toy demonstrations, just a lot of bizarre stuff that, as a student, I was very perplexed by what any of that had to do with the mission of Yale as a training ground for our intellectual elite and our political and cultural leaders.
Now, what about other students? Did you find yourself in a minority, or is there kind of a feeling that it's uncool to challenge or question this?
Yeah, I mean, I would say in general, students probably support it. They think it's no big deal. I mean, listen, this is the 21st century. My generation has grown up seeing everything you can imagine on the internet. And so nothing that went on there was particularly unheard of, I think, for my generation. But at least for me, the extreme elements of some of the pornography that was screened in classrooms, some of the violence of it, that did create a lot of controversy among students. There were several examples over the years where, you know, there was this one film which contained something called rape fantasy. I have no idea what that is, but that didn't go over so well. And then, one of the more graphic episodes that I talk about in the book, you know, I find myself sitting in the back of the classroom. I'm watching this film of this porn star, and she's getting beaten with a whip or something. And then before I know it, she's stripped down to her naked breasts in front of the class, and she's leading kids around in handcuffs. I mean, it's just, you have to stop at moments like that and say, what in the world is going on?
Well, there's an interesting paradox here, too, because we're speaking in the same week when an extremely conservative legislator who has got the Republican nomination for the Senate in Missouri.
Right, the Aiken fellow.
That's it. Made comments about rape that were very distressing to many, and particularly liberals.
Yeah, pretty dumb comments.
Yeah, and and here there seems to be, in this particular context, a kind of glorification or romanticizing of it. In fact, our reviewer, Hannah Rosen, makes a striking comparison. She says that your critique of that kind of rape fantasy actually reminded her of, you know, the famous feminist Andrea Dworkin's objections to it. So is there a larger moral issue at stake here as well?
I think so. You know, this is a very provocative issue both for feminists and for anybody who sort of cares about the direction of culture. Because, listen, we live in a highly pornified culture right now. I mean, people are exposed to this kind of material. But I, you know, to me, when you go from Hugh Hefner smiling and with a bunch of bleach blondes in his bathrobe, that's one thing. That's one image of pornography that I think a lot of people have, and certainly kind of what I this idea of the sort of brutality, the violence that characterizes so much of this wide open frontier of pornography today, that's what was really shocking to me. I grew up like not with any kind of extraordinary innocence or any kind of extraordinary lack of exposure to sex, but when I was introduced to this kind of really grotesque kind of degradation of women for profit, I mean, that to me was outrageous, and that was a huge motivating force for me when I set about to write the book. I mean, if anything got me burning and got me outraged, it was to see something like that going on.
Now, what about the classroom? You stayed, you got your degree. There were
sure.
brilliant scholars and professors.
Yes.
But what was the educational experience at this great university like for you? Did it fulfill those expectations at all?
Well, you know, if Yale wasn't an extraordinary university, then all the trash that's going on there wouldn't matter all that much. And I try to bring that point out, too, that I had some of the highest points of my life as a Yale student. I mean, some of the most extraordinary experiences. They paid and sent me to study in Rome one summer, and I had these sort of sweeping experiences walking around, you know, the Palatine Hill with leading experts in archaeology and art history. And another way of putting it, it's Disneyland for geeks. I mean, it's everything you can imagine. But at the other side of that, you feel like there's a huge lack of appreciation for that intellectual legacy, for the important role as even a curator of our intellectual history that a place like Yale really serves. To me, if you allow that space to be degraded by things that degrade women or that really have no serious intellectual purpose whatsoever, those become a real drag on the quality of the teaching there. And I think that you can't look at all of the shocking material that's going on without also tying it into a kind of indifference on the part of Yale's leaders as to the true and proper mission. Yale has the potential to be a truly extraordinary place. And that's something that means a lot to me as a Yale graduate. I mean, I still love the place.
So what should alumni or parents of Yale students do, assuming they know about this? Sex Week has been modified somewhat, I understand.
Yes.
Right. But what should their attitude be? What should people do?
It comes down to this. The Yale administration is responsible for what goes down in the classroom. I wouldn't be surprised if plenty of alumni or parents of alumni who read this book end up tearing up that donation envelope the next time it comes in the mail, because I think people want to feel that their donations are going toward a noble and high-minded purpose when they send money to a place like Yale. More broadly, though, I hope that there's some accountability with the higher-ups who run the place. At the end of the day, when you take a leadership position at a place like Yale, that's an important job with a lot of implied accountability there. And I don't think, based on my experience, that those leaders have taken that job as seriously as they ought to have. You know, academic freedom is not the same thing as having no academic standards.
Have you heard from administrators at Yale? Are they aware that your book is coming out? Will you speak on campus? Or what do you think the repercussions will be?
You can't write about the wrongdoing of powerful people and expect not to be the subject of some attack after that. And so I anticipate some of that with this book. The truth is the truth, and I hope that it's kind of a gut check for people about the direction of Yale in particular and elite academia in general.
Thanks so much, Nathan.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
That's Nathan Harden, whose new book, Sex and God at Yale, is reviewed on the cover of this week's book review. Julie Bosman's here with Notes from the Field. Hi, Julie.
Hi, Sam.
So another Navy SEALs book. Julie Bosman's here with Notes from the Field. Hi, Julie.
Hi, Sam.
So the Navy SEALs, there's an American love affair with them, and we seem to have learned about an important new book that's coming out.
It's a very good one, and this book will come out on September 11th, and it is a detailed first-person account of the raid that killed Osama bin Laden, and the author is one of the Navy SEALs who participated in the raid.
So this book is coming out in just a few weeks. We didn't know anything about it before.
That's right. It's been kept a very big secret by the publisher. The publisher is Dutton, an imprint of Penguin. And they've kept this under wraps. They haven't even told people within the company. Their sales representatives who talked to bookstores were told only that it was a big book that had been added to their fall list, and that it was written under a pseudonym, and that pseudonym is Mark Owen.
So they were told nothing at all about the content.
That's right, and booksellers were kept in the dark. Now, this is one of those books that booksellers absolutely hate, because they were told several weeks ago by their sales reps, look, there's this huge book, it's nonfiction, it's being added to the list this fall, and you should order a bunch of copies, but we can't tell you what the book is.
Well, you know, it makes you wonder, makes one wonder just about how publishing works, because here you have this extraordinary thing. Don't you kind of want to let people know just a little? Because otherwise, how does it really get introduced to the world? The book is just suddenly released. The author's not going to make appearances, I assume, if it's written pseudonymously.
He is. It's a very unusual publicity plan. What Dutton has planned is a publicity plan that will involve the author appearing in disguise to promote the book. They have at least one major primetime television appearance planned, and the author will appear on TV, but he will have his voice disguised, and I'm told with the help of a makeup artist and perhaps some other technological tricks, he will be on TV.
Why does the author need to be concealed in this way? Is his life in danger in any way?
For security purposes, apparently. The author doesn't want to be known by his full name. He wants to keep his identity a secret. And that is partly because of the great detail he's going into in this book. According to a description of the book by a publishing executive, he gives a blow-by-blow narrative of the assault on bin Laden. It begins with the helicopter crash that this Navy SEAL, he was in the helicopter, the Black Hawk that crashed. And the book goes through the radio call that confirmed bin Laden's death. So it's a very detailed account and very dramatic, I'm sure. But the author has decided that he does not want to be known. Whether that will remain true, I guess we'll find out.
Well, there will certainly be, one imagines, a kind of stampede to figure out who he is. Is he still a Navy SEAL?
He has retired from the Navy SEALs within the last year.
And has the Obama administration or the Navy Department of the Navy responded in any way to this? Are they aware of this project?
Not yet. They haven't said anything. They haven't publicly commented yet. But the traditional vetting process does require agencies to have a look at a book like this to make sure that it does not reveal any classified information. And I'm told that the book was lawyered very closely at the publishing house.
And another word that always comes up in these contexts, redacted. I mean, do we know whether parts of it have been censored or edited or changed, or it's still under wraps too much?
We don't know yet. A lot of the what's in the book is still very much a secret. Copies have not been distributed to reviewers or to bookstores. So we'll undoubtedly find out a lot more about that in the weeks to come.
And it will be released on September 11th, Julie?
It will. I'm told that the book begins and ends on 2 September 11th. It ends on a note of September 11th, 2011, when the author visited Ground Zero. And it wasn't long after that that he decided he wanted to retire from the Navy SEALs.
Thanks so much, Julie.
Thanks, Sam.
This year, once again, we have a back-to-school issue, and again, its mastermind is my colleague Pamela Paul, features editor and children's books editor of the New York Times Book Review, who's here to talk about it. Welcome, Pamela.
Hi, Sam.
All right, so we come around each year, and we really plan the issues like this far in advance. You want readers to understand that this is or may become a regular feature, but also you want to do different things. So what are some of the novelties we've introduced this time?
So we did a few new things. First of all, this is actually the first time in the book review that we are reviewing apps, which is a question that has been asked of us, I think, regularly of the last couple of years. When are we going to review apps? And so JD, who's a staff editor here at the book review.
JD Beersdorfer, otherwise known as Jude.
Did a great job reviewing apps about books, atlases specifically, and books about maps, which is going to be also, I think, a semi-regular column called Applied Reading.
So we'll do that maybe three or even four times a year.
Exactly.
Jude will write a column for us.
And that covers not just children's books, but adult book apps as well. And this is the first time, of course, that we've had a buy the book in the back-to-school issue, and so we thought it would be fun to get someone who is from the world of children's books, Ian Falconer, who is an illustrator for The New Yorker and, of course, the creator of Olivia, who's one of the most beloved contemporary pigs in children's books.
And it's the most charming illustration of himself that he gave us.
Yes, a stunning self-portrait that Olivia drew for him. And his new book, Olivia and the Fairy Princesses, is also reviewed in the issue by Bruce Handy from Vanity Fair, who is not only brilliant and hilarious, but also really gets the world of picture books.
Well, in fact, he is now, Bruce himself is writing a book about children's literature. What is it that makes him so good? We all agree that this is one of the really emerging talents in the world of children's books reviewing. And no one would have guessed that. I don't think Bruce would have. Why is he so good at it? What does he bring to it?
Well, it's interesting you ask that because it brings to mind an answer that Ian Falconer gave in his interview in which I asked, you know, did he ever want to write for grown-ups? And he said, but I do write for grown-ups. And that is, you know, he doesn't condescend to children and he doesn't assume that children are his only reader. And in the same way, Bruce Handy does not condescend to this whole world of children's books. He reads it, you know, as he would read, I think, an adult book with the same amount of interest and respect. And his book, I believe, is about what it's like to read these books once more as a grown-up.
Because he has kids, and now they're teenagers, but it is a striking experience for all parents to kind of relive one's book reading childhood by reading books aloud to children, or as the kids grow older, seeing them discover authors themselves. And Bruce seems particularly good at that. Alison Lurie, the great novelist and children's books writer, is really good at that too, is seeing that intersection between children and adults.
And I think you bring up another point, which is that the going back to children's books that you enjoyed as a child, because I think we're living in many ways in this sort of second golden era of children's books. And, you know, this is a generation that grew up on the great books of Maurice Sendak and of Katherine Patterson and all those great school books, A Separate Piece and The Chocolate War. Now you see the parents obviously bringing continuing to read those books, but also children's book authors who grew up reading those books, writing often these kind of a kind of mixed novel that's nostalgic in part and also very contemporary. So one of the novels that we review in this issue is Liar and Spy by Rebecca Stead. And of course, she won the Newbery for When You Reach Me, which was about growing up in 1970s New York and about A Wrinkle in Time and revisiting that. And her new book, Liar and Spy, is a similar kind of contemporary nostalgic mix.
Now, Pamela, school is just not for the very young, also college students. We have a couple of essays, provocative essays on the cover that look at different aspects of academic life. But then on the back page, you've returned to a real classic that many of our listeners will remember
Yeah, and once again, the nostalgia. The Norton Anthology, I think that anyone who was an English major or took an introductory English course remembers getting that huge brick of a book, the Norton Anthology of English Literature, Volume 1 and Volume 2, each of them immense with the incredible paper-thin paper. But that really is the book that introduces college students to the world of, you know, Beowulf, everything from Beowulf to the Romantics.
So, Pamela, what you did then was to go to, we'll call him the godfather of the Norton Anthology, the great critic and scholar, M.H. Abrams, longtime professor at Cornell University, and set up a dialogue between him and Meyer Abrams, remarkably, is 100 years old, now turns 100 this year, with his successor, another very renowned scholar and critic, Stephen Greenblatt of Harvard University. And what do these two have to say to each other?
So it's great because it is the founding editor talking about the Norton with the current editor. And what's so amazing about the Norton is that it both kind of directs, I wouldn't say dictates, but, you know, directs and shapes what students study in freshman English and throughout their undergraduate years. And it also reflects the changing face of what is being studied in those classes. So it's, in a way, a kind of counterpoint to our cover reviews, which are very critical and see the, you know, the academy is going on this, you know, terrible downward slope. And yet a lot remains the same and remains about, you know, these great books and these great works of literature and poetry.
And Professors Abrams and Greenblatt describe how the content of this volume does change over time. Yes, they're classics. It's a great tradition. But the meaning and inclusiveness of the idea of tradition changes over time, partly reflecting generational differences, taste, the expanding world of literature. What do these two scholars have to say about that?
Well, I think that, you know, it is an interesting mix and also of their own preferences. Abrams, of course, is a great fan of the Romantics. And Greenblatt has, I think, a little bit of more of an interest in the modern and also in Renaissance poetry he talks about. So it reflects in part their own preferences at the same time. Obviously, the, you know, years of culture wars and the introduction of more multicultural curricula into universities has affected what's in.
So that's reflected in the book.
Yes.
Well, when I used the Norton Anthology, dating myself here, but in the mid-1970s, it was English literature. I mean, they'd let in an outlier like T.S. Eliot, because he changed citizenship. I mean, that's how narrow it was. And it's somewhat different today. Is that
right? It's a little bit different. I mean, they do have an anthology for American literature, but it is English-speaking nations. But it is still, I think, very much about that traditional canon. And, you know, there is a lot of very good reasons to study that. And so it's great to have all of that in that one volume.
Did either Meyer Abrams or Stephen Greenblatt, or maybe both, talk about what it's like to teach from the volume? Are they active teachers?
Absolutely. I mean, well, Greenblatt is actively teaching, and in fact, he teaches a class with Louis Menand, another great literary scholar up at Harvard.
And New Yorker contributor.
And they teach a class about the great books that they just introduced recently, and it turned out to be one of the most popular classes at Harvard. So there really is an ongoing hunger for this kind of basic canonical knowledge.
Well, in the end, you kind of come back to the great books, I suppose.
Absolutely.
Thanks so much, Pamela.
Thank you.
And now Parle Sagal's here with Bestseller News. Hey, Parle.
Hi, Sam.
What's new on the list this week? Let's do fiction first.
Fiction. We have at number 2, Ain't It Rose Harbor by Debbie McComber. Number 4, Kingmaker's Daughter by Philippa Gregory. And on the extended list, at number 18, there's Where'd You Go, Bernadette by Maria Semple. And at 23, St. Zita Society by Ruth Rendell.
Now, the Maria Semple novel, Julie Bosman has talked about that. Do you have any feelings about that? Have you looked at that novel?
Yeah, I have. And it's a pretty interesting pastiche of emails and invoices and bills. It's not a standard linear narrative. And it makes sense because the book itself is about a 15-year-old girl who's trying to figure out where her mother's gone. Her mother's disappeared. And so it's evidence, in a way, that she's sort of sifting through.
And what about nonfiction?
And nonfiction, at number three, we have Solo, a memoir by Hope Solo, the goalie for the U.S. national soccer team.
Which won the gold medal.
That's right. At number five, we have Obama's America from Dinesh D'Souza. And at 11, Paris, a Love Story by Cady Martin.
Anything interesting on the extended list?
On the extended list, we have at number 22, Monkey Mind. It's a tragic comic memoir by Daniel Smith. He was a young, he started out as a fact checker for The Atlantic and became an editor and suffered all his life from really, really severe anxiety. He would have to wear maxi pads under all of his shirts because he would sweat through them. Just horrible stuff, panic attacks. As luck would have it, he was the son of a woman who specialized in panic attacks and anxiety disorder. So it's a book of coming to terms with this, trying to find its roots in his own life and his own heritage. He describes anxiety as being a Jewish disease, you know, the disease of Moses and Philip Roth and Lenny Bruce and Fran Lebowitz. And,
probably makes her a pretty good fact checker, actually.
Well, this is brilliant. I love that you brought that up because there's a huge section about how his job exacerbated his tendencies, how you have to live in a state of constant alertness and you live in the kingdom of error. You know, so he describes how his job really sort of pushed him over the edge.
Now, does he suggest at all, and I know we have an excellent review of this book, but does he suggest, Daniel Smith suggests at all, that because his mother was professionally dealing with these issues, that might be an explanation at all for his having contracted it or been afflicted with it?
I think, he looks at a number of possible routes. His mother also, he describes, went into studying anxiety because she suffered from pretty intense anxiety. So, I mean, again, it's also, as the book makes clear, it's something that up to 18% of the population suffers from.
So, yeah, I'd like to meet any one of the 82% that doesn't, because I don't think I know anybody.
Well, that's right. I mean, and it's also interesting because he goes through a bunch of cures. He tries a bunch of things, and finally he settles on the one thing that can sort of jolt him out of his panic attacks, and that's Singing in the Rain. He watches the DVD of Singing in the Rain, and that sort of
that calms him down.
And Xanax.
Kelly's quick taps.
That's right.
With the artificial raindrops falling.
That's right.
Well, it worked for me. Thanks a lot, Parle.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening. And remember, there's more at nytimes.com/books. You can tell us what you think of this show or any New York Times podcast by emailing podcasts@nytimes.com. I'm Sam Tannenhaus.